Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight. This is our August 1st, 2015 show. We really appreciate you listening and supporting independent musicians all over the world. My guest tonight is Linda Dactyl. Linda is a performer, a composer, former adjunct music instructor at Kenyon College and Ohio Wesleyan University. Her playing experience includes jazz, blues, rock, and classical music genres. She leads a B3 jazz organ quartet as a member of ESKIP, an original eclectic rock group, and plays drums for the popular local hard rock band Uncle Fester. Linda, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on this evening.
Oh, it's great to have you. Do you have any spare time at all, Linda?
Yeah, I do, actually, yes. In fact, I've do some studio teaching here at my home and out at Michelle Tuesday Music Studios, and then play a lot of engagements and, you know, between the different things I do. And I still have some free time to enjoy the summer and go to the pool every once in a while, that kind of stuff. So,
well, yeah. That's good. It does sound like you have a lot of things going on. One of the things that I like to accomplish in these interviews is to get a nice package put together, so when people will listen to the podcast, they get to know about the person. One of the reasons, Linda, that I started doing these interviews, a long time ago, I was walking my dog, and this has been years back, and I was listening to one of the local stations here in Columbus, and I heard them interview Meatloaf, and I didn't really like Meatloaf. I didn't think he was – he's okay. He was good. It just didn't – to me, it wasn't something I was interested in. But I listened to the interview, and the interview was so good because it made me know who the person was. And instead of just listening to the music, now I knew about who he was, what he went through to get to where he was, all the sacrifices he made, and the things – and then all of a sudden to me, Linda, the music started – being more, wow, okay, now I kind of get it. So then I thought, maybe I could do that. And that's what I started doing. And I thought, you know, I just want people to know about the musician. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's like an addiction. Once you get bit by the music bug, and it's something that, you know, I've interviewed people from all over the world, and I've known people, Linda, that have put their instruments down for, you know, 20 or 30 years, but they pick them up eventually because it's such a part of them. So what I would like to do, start off, is let's get an idea, Linda, of how what it was like for you when you were growing up, and a little bit of like where you grew up, and then how what part was music in that, in your family, and how that was integrated into you growing up? Because I think that's always interesting to me. I've talked to folks that said, you know, I was a very musical family. Some of them said, well, there was no music at all in the family. So how was it for Linda Dactyl growing up?
Well, basically how I got started on the music path, there was a large truck that came to the house one afternoon. I think I was 6 years old, and it's like, well, what is that? And my dad had bought an organ from Sears, of all places. And it's like, you know, he brought it in the house, and he says, you're going to play this. And that's, you know, Mom and Dad decided to just get one. I guess they wanted me to, you know, channel some energy. I wasn't, you know, a terrible kid, but I guess I was a little bit hyper. And so I started taking music lessons at Petro Music Studios in Dover, Ohio. And I studied with several teachers at that time. I studied with a college girl, Deborah Miller. She lived down the road about a mile. She had worked for Petro's, and then she decided to teach in her home. And then she went to college, and I studied with another lady, Doris McClelland. I think she's still alive in Florida. She's in her 90s now. And, you know, just different people over the years. And, you know, I have to say, you know, at a young age, you know, I mean, I liked it, but, you know, that would wax and wane a bit. But my folks were like, well, you know, as far as your school activities, you have music lessons, and you're going to do that. You can do one other thing. And they were pretty strict about it, not in a, you know, forcing my hand kind of way, but it's like, no, you're not going to quit lessons and that kind of thing. You know, because sometimes kids, you know, they go through this little period of time where they really love it, and then, you know, their interest, you know, isn't as much. And then, but my parents never let me quit, and that's good because, you know, I learned to love it eventually. You know, in some of those times that, you know, I wasn't so happy about playing lightly row and all those different things that you have to learn when you're a kid, you know, to get acclimated to the instrument.
Right. Now, do you remember? Well, how old were you? I can talk. How old were you, Linda, when that truck pulled up in front of your house?
I was like about 6 and a half. I was already in school in first grade, and then, you know, I just took lessons on that organ until it was a small one. It had pedals and everything. It wasn't like a little chord organ or whatever. And then, you know, we ended up getting another organ, I think when I was probably about 11, and that was a Lowry organ, and I studied again at Petro's Music Studios. They've closed a number of years ago, was two brothers that ran it, and they moved to Florida. I don't know if they're still living or not, but you know, played Lowry for a while, and then you know, I heard the Hammond, Lee Michaels actually,
had
that hit. Do You Know What I Mean? And yeah, I was listening to Three Dog Night, and Yes, you know, which is still an influence on me to this day. And it's like, well, you know, do you think maybe we could get a Hammond? And you know, my mom was saw what a B3 looked like, and you know, we kind of joke about it. She said, you know, that early American furniture just doesn't match our living room. And it's like, but when she heard it, she's like, oh, yeah, okay, you know, so, yeah, that sounds really good and that. And we sold the Lowry to a friend of the family, and, you know, that money plus $600 bought my B2 Hammond that we upgraded with percussion to make it sound like a B3 and a 147 Leslie, and that organ's sitting in my living room now. And it's not, I don't take it out on gigs. It's a very good instrument. You know, I have some other things I take out for that, but you know, that's kind of how that whole organ thing got started. And you know, I just had a big interest in that, particularly in those groups I mentioned. And then I got bit by the progressive rock bug when I was, you know, probably about 11 or 12. And, you know, it just kind of like music, music, music. And then jazz, you know, later I got interested in jazz. I don't know, I probably was early years of high school. I heard Maynard Ferguson on PBS stations, locally Cleveland stations. And it was like, you know, that he kind of, his music perked my interest in jazz. And so, you know, it's all kind of a mix and conglomerate of all those influences coming from the rock and the blues and the, you know, jazz, you know, and still it's, you know, pretty consistent to this day. I still listen to all those people and a lot of new artists too, of course, but, you know, that's kind of my roots, probably Lee Michaels, Wakeman, Emerson, John Lord, and then, you know, through the jazz thing later, Jimmy Smith and Jimmy McGriff, and various artists, you know, in the jazz organ genre. And I do have to say, when I came here to Columbus, I guess the instrument that I had was a Fender Rhodes piano, and I had that Hammond at home, and it was like, well, how could I ever move it around and all this kind of
right,
stuff? So
yeah.
I kind of concentrated on, you know, playing keyboards, you know, just, you know, keyboards and that. And I'm also a drummer, too, so I've always split my time between, you know, playing keyboards or drums in various things. But I saw Hank Marr play, and, you know, he used to have a jam with Rusty Bryant up at the Anchor Inn up on Morse Road, and it's since become a, who knows, a Howard Johnson's or some other kind of a motel, but the Anchor Inn was a place to go. And I just was like, wow, you know, I got to hear somebody play B3 in a way that I had not been exposed to, really. You know, I'd heard the rock stuff, of course. You know, I was playing mostly, you know, no pedals and that kind of thing. And then, of course, I'd heard the theater organ stuff and all that. And here, this is my first, for instance, to walk in and see a jazz trio and or quartet. I don't remember what all Hank's instrumentation was. I know Rusty was on sax, Jim Rupp on drums, Hank on the organ, possibly Tom Carroll, and a different guitarist on those gigs. And I couldn't believe it because I didn't see a bass. Didn't see a bass guitar.
Right.
I heard all this stuff coming out of the organ. And I didn't see Hank's feet move all that much. You know, some. And I was like, you know, and I just didn't quite understand what was going on. And I later, you know, studied with Hank, and, you know, he explained all that. And, you know, so, you know, that probably takes me through my college years. And, you know, and I just have always played. You know, I think there's been short periods of time when I've taken some time off. I took a little time off playing when I was first teaching. And, you know, just because of the schedule and that. But, you know, that didn't last for more than 4 or 5 months. You know, it felt like it wasn't a good feeling, you know, to not gig. And, you know, and, you know, ever since then, I've pretty much always done it, you know, either heavily or moderately ever since that time.
Now, Linda, I look at through, you know, there when you started off and you were 6.5, 7 years old, and the organ came, and you mentioned, I believe it was Doris McLennan that was one of your teachers. I think that's who you said. But
yeah, McLellan. That was her
McLellan.
Name. Is her name, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking about that because I look back at my life and I look at people that were very influential to kind of keep John on the right path and to get me interested and build confidence. And music was one of the things in my life that worked with. Now, when you look back, Linda, at people, you know, like Doris, how do you think they influenced you to keep you on track and to help you with that and to build confidence as a musician? And how do mm-hmm. you do that yourself today with people? I mean, is that something that you can look back and think, yeah, and I've done this with this person? Because I think that's one of the things I've been recently working with some people and talking to some folks about, you know, how some kids, my daughter's a social worker and she works with a lot of troubled kids. And I think music and art is so important to build confidence and to help kids in areas that they could never get help in just normal life. And I that's why I'm saying that. I'm kind of looking back, and as you mentioned her, how big was that for in your life?
Well, the thing is I studied with Doris. She was from Millersburg, Ohio. She, like I said, I haven't been in touch with her for years, but she'd be in her 90s, and I think she's still living. I've tried to locate her. I haven't had a whole lot of luck with that. But the thing is that she had me early on when I was a little bit squirrely. And, we didn't particularly get along. I mean, you know, a little kid, you know, you just kind of sit there and do the lesson and, you know, as well, you need to practice more and this kind of stuff. But, I ended up studying with some other teachers concerning organ. I went back with the Petro brothers, and they were more, how would I say, they weren't jazz players, but they did the restaurant thing, and that was a big thing at the time. And they basically taught me how to read lead sheets, you know, when I was about 9 or 10 years old, and I didn't know that that's what I was doing. You know, I was learning chord theory and all that stuff, not on a jazz level, more like playing tunes like Delilah and Hello Dolly and those kinds of things. But the thing is Doris and I got back in touch. When I was a little kid, I noticed that her music room was full of instruments. She had organ and piano. She had, you know, one of the big Hammonds at that time. I don't remember. It was probably like an X-77. Hammond players will know what that is. It's kind of space-age-looking thing with all kinds of gadgetry and all that kind of stuff. And she had a piano in there, and then she had a marimba. And, I played drums in the school band, and I wanted to really get more serious about that. And so I called Doris again when I was a little bit older and started taking marimba lessons with her. At that time, we really hit it off. And I was a little older and a little more mature. And she ended up having me go with her to her social club things. And we'd play marimba duets and whatever. And she had these little puppet things she put on the mallets and stuff. And, you know, it was just kind of, it wasn't like a ladies'
cool.
tea, but it was like, you know, I don't know if it was Rotary Club or whatever. But we ended up, you know, being, you know, very, you know, when I was a little older, I think she saw that I had some talent when I was younger, and it's like, you know, I need to, like, you know, kind of push this kid a little bit. And she did, but at the time I wasn't so receptive to that, but I was later. And she ended up coming to both my graduate and undergraduate recitals. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, that was quite a trip for her and that because I grew up in Holmes County, up there around Millersburg, Ohio. Actually, I grew up in Bunker Hill Village, which is about 7 miles out of Millersburg, middle of Amish country. And
right.
So for her to travel to Columbus, and she was already, you know, a little up in age, it was quite an honor. And I got to introduce her to another lady that's historically involved with marimba. She passed a number of years ago, Ruth Jean. She was the person that premiered Paul Creston's concertino for marimba, which for years and years was the marimba piece that you played. It was you know, one of the first works for the marimba. And so anyway, you know, that's kind of how it was. You know, I can't say that, you know, I was a child prodigy or anything like that. You know, I had a lot of interest. But one thing about Doris that really interested me that I probably wasn't, you know, quite understanding why, is that she had all these instruments in the house, and she played them all. And
that's
she played
awesome.
Violin and this marimba and all this stuff. So, you know, that's, I guess that's about it about her. And I had another lady, and she passed too, and she taught until her 90s. Her name was Loretta Maybaugh, and she had a Hammond. And, you know, she was a beautiful lady, and she was very strict, too, because, you know, I always had this ability to improvise, and she'd have me play these pieces, and I'd put runs in it, and she'd say, well, now, why are you doing that? I said, well, because it sounds good, and she loved Liberace, so she wasn't one of these people about, you know, improvising is bad and whatever, but she said, you know, you're here so I can teach you how to read music, and so, you know, I, you know, kind of got a little bit more focused on that. But the thing I remember about her was she had this little spinet Hammond M3 in her living room, and she had this Leslie out in her kitchen. And it was like if I had a particularly good lesson, she'd let me just play whatever I want, like the last, you know, 5-10 minutes or whenever the next student came. And, you know, she was a delightful lady, and I learned an awful lot from her, too.
Well, I think that's so important to look back and to see those people that, you know, I guess they're like, you know, like lighthouses or something, you know, that stand out in your life, because I look back too at that, and I look at, I had some teachers, and my choir teacher in high school was one of the toughest teachers and people I've ever met, and she was incredible. I mean, she taught us so many things. And I look back at that now and I think, you know, I'm not real sure what would have happened if I wouldn't have been in touch with that person, because she got me so interested in music. And I just think it's kind of cool to do that. Now, let's talk for a minute, Linda, about children, kids, whatever you want to call them, students, young people today. And what is your take on how important it is for them to be, you know, not just, you know, maybe one period of, you know, some type of art class, but to be really open and to have that opportunity to, you know, for music and for art and things like that, because that's one thing I like to talk to some of my guests about. I'm very passionate about that, because I think it's missing a lot of times. You know, we get budget cuts, we get all this, mm-hmm. They take away the art. And they take away the things that, you know, maybe in tradition they'll think, well, you need English, you need math, you need this and that. But to me, it's like that didn't work for me. What mm-hmm. got me the confidence was, you know, was music. And I tell this story sometimes. It's kind of, I don't know if it's any good or not. But when I was young, I grew up in the 60s and into the 70s and high school and middle school in the 60s. And that's when, you know, the British invasion came, and I was like a huge fan of the Animals, and I loved the Animals, and I thought, and I can remember, Linda, sitting in middle school in my hometown thinking about how I could be in the Animals. And I was sitting there looking out the window, and I was thinking the greatest thing in the world would be if I could be in that band, the Animals. And I can remember the teacher was asking me a question, and I was nowhere near planet Earth. I was like, wow, I was out there. And I just remember that, you know, I always had that desire for music. Now, what do you think about how we can cultivate, you know, young people today and how we can get them to you know, I think to reach their potential with their lives through music?
Well, I think, I really think that the school music programs are very important. Now, I did have a lot of training outside of that environment. But, well, you know, I had some influential teachers, particularly when I was in middle school. I had a gentleman, he was my band director and also the general music teacher. His name's Jack Schmidt. And, he may be listening in. I'm not sure. I'll let him know about the podcast. But I particularly liked his general music class because I remember taking in the Yes album, Fragile.
Yep, and I that's a great album.
I didn't know what some of these instruments were. I said, do you know what a mellotron is? He says, well, I don't know what that is, but I know what a Moog synthesizer is. And he gave me his Switched on Bach album to take home and listen to. He had trusted me, you know, with it, and I took it home and brought it back, you know, in a couple days' time. We had to do reports, so I just chose to do a report on the Moog synthesizer. And, you know, I think that was very a very important thing. It seems like maybe an insignificant event, but I think it was very significant for me because that generated my interest in synthesizers, you know, for him to answer the question and allow me to take his album home to listen to and that kind of thing. And, I mean, as far as my school work is, I mean, I actually enjoyed school quite a bit. I mean, there were some things I didn't enjoy as much, you know, some of the subjects and stuff, but, you know, I wasn't a poor student. I wasn't, you know, a genius or anything like that. But the thing is, music was very important to me, particularly growing up in a rural area where there wasn't a whole lot to do other than sports. And I was involved in sports somewhat. I actually played on a woman's softball team when I was quite young. There's all boys in the neighborhood, and all we did was play softball in the summers, and Amish kids and that. And, so I did a little softball, but that wasn't a school involvement. So, I mean, I couldn't really keep up with that because, there's a lot of traveling and that kind of stuff. But, you know, the music stuff, getting snowed in those terrible winter blizzards and such, you know, it just was a way to entertain myself. And you know, I enjoyed watching television and all that kind of stuff, too. But I was always more interested in going up into my room and listening to my albums and, and just kind of fiddling around, you know. I mean, and I had formal studies going on, too, you know, and reading about music. I used to buy Circus magazine all the time, have pictures of the artists all over my walls, you know, Yes and Alice Cooper and Bowie and, you know, all those, you know, people from that time. And so music was an escape for me, a very healthy escape, just something to keep me occupied and, you know, keep me from getting into trouble, I guess. I mean, you know, you have to, you know, with kids and such, you have to keep them occupied and engaged. But, you know, for me, I was pretty much a self-starter because, once I got to be about 11 or 12 years old, you know, my folks didn't have to say, now, Linda, you need to go down and practice and all this kind of stuff. That's when I was younger. So, I mean, I was pretty much a self-starter at that time. And, it just made me feel good, you know, to be able to do it. It's exciting. It still is, or I wouldn't be doing it now. And, I think it's so important. And, experience as an educator, right now I'm just teaching privately. I had taught, a number of years adjunct in the colleges. I enjoyed that very, very much. And I taught in the schools, mostly the Diocese of Columbus. Now, I taught a little bit of public school in the Dayton area early on. But, I had very small programs in those, Catholic schools, really small. And one of them, Bishop Hartley and also Father Worley, which Father Worley closed in 1991, I still have students from those programs. Some of them have gone on to do music. You know, I don't know, some seriously and some, as a very serious hobby. And I basically had to do what I would call the Jack Black School of Rock before Jack Black existed or people knew about him, because I'd get a smattering of instrumentation, guitar players signing up, drums, clarinet, flute, whatever. So what I ended up doing was I separated the two groups into two combos and taught music skills on reading and all that kind of stuff too, but taught improv and, with the guitar students and drum, bass, that kind of thing. We actually played rock tunes and we worked on them until we got them the sound as close to the recordings as we could. We give concerts at the school, and that was a very positive experience for a number of my students. I have one that comes over here, and he's recording a thing. His name is Pete. He goes by Pete Lau Sound, and he has that thing where he does Laotian rock music in social clubs across the country.
Wow.
Of Laotian people. And I hadn't seen him for years. We kind of got back in touch. And then, yeah, there's some other students along the way. Fella, if I start naming names, I won't be able to get them all in. But a drummer, student of mine, lives out in the Denver area. And, you know, he plays in cover bands out there. And, you know, so it's just nice to see, you know, years later, you know, these people that were in my life when they were quite young, you know, our paths are crossing and they're still doing music.
You know, that's got to be a great feeling. That may be, to me, it's like, I love that when I see somebody in my life that was influential in a positive way to me, because I really believe that, you know, when you were playing rock music with these guys in the schools, I mean, they were probably pretty blown away by that, because there may not have been a lot of people that would do that. And
mm-hmm.
to get them interested in something that they actually liked, that's just really cool. My guest is Linda Dactyl. You can go on her website, dactyl.com. Also, I believe summitrecords.com. And her latest release is a late one. You believe you can purchase her album on both of those websites. And also, it's in CD form. And I think we'll take a music break, Linda, and then we'll be back. And we'll talk about the making of the latest album, and we've got a lot to talk about. We may have to have a part two. I can feel
okay.
It coming on. But let's play Silver Spoon. I think could you talk about that a little bit? That's from your Blue Bop album from 2006. Is that correct?
That's correct. In fact, Hank Marr. That's a tune by Hank Marr, and. Let me see here. The other composer's last name, Red, R-E-D-D. And I guess he was with King Records down in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah.
King
that's
Federal.
Awesome.
Right, and that's an older tune. But Hank passed in 2004, and Tony Monaco, who's internationally famous B3 player here from Columbus, decided to start a record label called Chicken Coop Records in you know, as a label connected to Summit Records. And Tony came out with a record. He did Hank's Greasy Spoon. Hank was known for the tune Greasy Spoon back in the 60s. And he wanted me to do some tributes to Hank also. And on that particular recording, Silver Spoon, that is the alumni of Hank's quartet. Jim Rupp on the drums, Tom Carroll on guitar, and the late Gene Walker on tenor saxophone. Gene and I had a long history of playing together from around that time. We played together for, you know, I would say probably 7 or 8 years. Gene's health started to decline in his latter years, but, you know, he kept as active as he could. And so, you know, Tony had done Greasy Spoon, and he said, Linda, I want you to do, you know, two, three things in, you know, memory of Hank. And so I listened to Hank's old King Federal catalog and chose Silver Spoon. I chose a couple others. There's a Bridge to Shangri-La. And then we did Tenderly, which is a standard. Hank, that was one of the pieces that Hank had taught me. So anyway, that's pretty much the history on that. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, it's awesome. This is John Talk Radio, and my guest is Linda Dactyl, and this is Silver Spoon. We'll be right back after this to continue our interview with Linda.
Thank you.
welcome everyone back to John Talk Radio. My guest is Linda Dactyl, and her website is dactyl.com, D-A-C-H-T-Y-L, and also Summit Records. And you can check out her latest album, a late one, which we started the show off with, and also that's a CD. And you can go on her website and see when she's going to be playing and check out, you know, the live shows, which I think are amazing. And I'm looking forward, Linda, next week to see you play live in London, Ohio, which is real close to me. So that'll be great. One thing I wanted to talk to you about was the composing of songs and the songwriting process. How did that start with you? When did you start? Do you remember, like, the first song you wrote and how that process was? And has that progressed, or is it basically kind of the same? Walk us through the songwriting process, Linda.
Okay, well, I primarily write instrumental music in the E-Skip band. That's more of a collective thing. Larry Smith and I will co-write some things, and that band is Larry Smith on guitar and vocals, me on multi-keyboards, Dave Williams on bass, and Kerry Dactyl, my husband, on drums. And, you know, that is a little different thing, because I wouldn't consider myself a songwriter, but I would consider myself an instrumental composer. And basically, I'd say the first tune that I ever wrote, well, it was something called Skyline Haze. It was a bossa nova tune I wrote when I was a freshman in college, actually. I kind of fooled around with composition. You know, I had a good theory teacher in high school, a fellow named Jim Murphy. He ended up working for the Kent City Schools for a number of years. And he had us do some, you know, exercises that way in theory class. But, you know, it was never anything, you know, that, you know, I would put out there, so to speak. But I studied with Dave Wheeler, the late Dave Wheeler, and I studied with him through my college years. And then there was a little, you know, time in between that, you know, I wasn't in touch with him too much, and I started running into him out of the Super Duper out near Bishop Hartley High School. I'd go over there, you know, get some groceries or whatever, if, you know, going home from work, and I ran into him 2-3 times, and ended up renting some studio space from one of his students, and he was talking about studying with Dave, and I said, well, yeah, Dave's still teaching, and I ran into him in the store, and then, you know, we got back together, you know, as a teacher-student kind of thing, and he became quite a close friend of Kerry and mine. He passed in 2008, but, you know, it was mostly, you know, through Dave Wheeler's classes in at Capitol when I was a student there, because he was very thorough. He was, back in that day, they didn't have, like, PhDs in jazz. I mean, the PhD in jazz was basically street learning. And Dave, you know, had some formal training himself. He was in, I'm not sure which branch of service. I think he was in the Navy. I'm not certain on that, or Air Force, I believe. But, you know, he was in, you know, the band programs there. But, you know, basically he was a self-taught player, and he was self-taught on piano. He told me that he never took a piano lesson in his life. And, you know, for anybody that had an opportunity to hear him play, you know, you almost couldn't believe that, because he was very, very, you know, had very good technique and just a genius, you know, brilliant, brilliant mind for theory and all that. And he actually was a country boy. He grew up in Coshocton, Ohio. He shared that with me. And when I told him I had grown up in Millersburg, you know, and he said, oh, I just, you know, I grew up in Coshocton, for what it's worth. But I got most of my, you know, I guess my thought process on how to put things together from taking Dave Wheeler's jazz composition classes, because the thing that he had us do is he'd go through the periods of jazz, starting with ragtime, and, you know, this is how you write a tune that will have a ragtime sound. You don't want to use these, you know, upper extension chords and all that. This is kind of the stuff, you know, that you want to use here, and then he'd give us an assignment, and, you know, we'd write it. And actually, that ragtime piece that I wrote for that class ended up getting published by Permis Publications, which we now own. The late Dr. James L. Moore passed last year, and it was his one of his dying wishes for Carrie to take over that publishing company. And you know, so that's another thing too. You know, a whole lot of, you know, you meet these different people and how, you know, all these synchronistic events happen. But Dave had us write that. He had us write a swing tune. He had us write, you know, jazz fusion. He had a couple of assignments. It's like, you know, write whatever you want, you know, and he just, you know, evaluated on how your form was and that kind of stuff. So basically when I write, I have a really good feel for, the song forms of jazz and that kind of thing. Without getting too technical, there's a number. You can write a blues form. You can write what we call the AABA form, which was used in a lot of show tunes. Those are some of the standard forms of jazz compositions, and there's other ones other than that too. But I usually start from there, and I find out that, you know, when I'm writing a jazz tune, if I can come up with a really good A section, you know, especially if you're writing an AABA tune, you've got, you know, 3/4 of the tune already written. You know, if you come up with a good 8 bars, and then you write a bridge, and then you write an intro, and then you write a tag. And that's usually how I do it rather than sitting down, because before I had that kind of instruction from Dave, you know, I probably have shoe boxes full of, you know, 200 intros, you know, that never went anywhere.
Wow.
And that kind of thing. But, you know, Dave was able to present things in a way, you know, and it sounds like it's very structured, and there's the thing about, you know, I just want to be free and creative and all that. But the thing is that you've got to channel that. And I found that Dave was able to break that down, you know, and how to, like, be creative, but channel something into a form, you know, so things aren't meandering all over the place, and so things make sense. And I still use those techniques that Dave taught in those classes to this day. In fact, with a late one, without getting overly analytical, I ended up writing, that one's a little more freeform than some of my other ones, but it does have a definite structure. You know, it's got an A section, it's got a bridge, an intro, and a coda kind of thing. But most of that stuff, you know, just the thought process I learned from Dave. And, one of the tunes I sent you, I don't know if you'll play that, but I think you did on the July 29th show, was La Chatte Blues. In fact, Dave and I took that into Dave. We recorded that in 2007. And Dave was still teaching. His health was starting to decline at that time. But I took that in to him, and he says, this is great. I mean, he really, I was just very, very flattered, because he said, I really, really like this. And he said, the thing is, you need a bridge for this. And he said, now, because it's so busy in the A section, you need to, like, write long notes in the bridge. And then, you know, he said, go to this key. And I said, well, Dave, I said, I should put your name on that too. And he says, oh, no, you're doing the writing. But he said, this is what I suggest. And I did that. And, he loved that tune. And, it was one of the last, some of the last lessons that we had, you know, was, during that time too. So, I mean, it's special in that regard too. But I would say Dave Wheeler's responsible for, being able to think as a composer. And, you know, I had all the classical theory, too, when I went to Capitol, and that was very good. And I find use for that. It's not one of those classes where it's like, oh, I'm so glad I got through, and now I can forget about this or whatever. For me, I've always enjoyed music theory, some a little more than others. You know, the classical theory that's taught is called common practice, and it's very rigid. And, you know, that kind of a thing. But, I learned an awful lot from that, too, you know, just how to put things together. But Dave was the one that really, kind of helped channel that stuff just by his thorough teaching methods.
Now, with this latest release, a late one, talk about that, Linda. We've got just a little bit, around 10 minutes left. And,
okay.
I would like to know, I'm how was this different from some of the other recordings you had? And talk about how I love for people to understand how musicians like plan and how like the song selection and the feel of the album and you know how it probably started with thoughts about things and how that it you know then it, into the recording studio and talk about that just a little bit. I think that's really fascinating.
Okay, well, we recorded that album here. The first two albums I recorded at Tony Monaco's studio, and Tony had a lot of involvement with this, even though we didn't record it at his place. Basically, he spends a lot of time on the road and that kind of thing. And Carrie has become quite a recording engineer in the last dozen years. Teenie Tucker's done two, possibly three of her CDs here, wow. Soul Seder recordings. We used to play with a group called Soul Seder with John McNamee. That was a large group. We did that here. And then, you know, he's done everything from string quartets to, you know, people doing opera and whatnot. He even recorded a big band here. So when Carrie and I talked about doing another CD together, and I had not done a solo CD since 2008, although I had been involved, you know, with Teenie's recording and Soul Seder and you know, just different clients coming in wanting organ tracks and such. But so we recorded it here, and Tony and I talked about the, you know, what tunes to do. I mean, I chose them. I said, you know, what do you think about this? You know, ran these all by him. And, you know, basically, you know, there's kind of a thing for organ album. There's no formula for it, but, you know, you want to keep things mixed up on the tempos and that kind of stuff. You don't want everything to be, you know, the same thing, you know, same flavor from tune to tune. And so Don Hales came into the picture. I knew of Don for years. He's been a friend of Tony Monaco's and used to play with Tony's family and that when they had Monaco's Palace back in the 80s and or 90s. I think it was 80s it was.
Right.
And Don and I got reacquainted a few years ago when he released an album with Tony through Chicken Coop. But then we were put together when Gene Walker died. We were asked to play down at the Lincoln Theater for Gene's memorial, and Carrie and Don and I played All the Things You Are, and I didn't have sax on that. I did record it with sax with Gene, but in Gene's, you know, since, you know, in Gene's absence, we did not do it with sax. That was, you know, symbolic, you know, that, you know, because of Gene's passing and such.
Right.
And so, you know, we kind of got along quite well musically and personally. And so I invited Don into the band to, you know, do the recording and just went from there. That's the core group, the three of us. And then, you know, I hire various sax players. Mark Donovan has been with me for quite a while, and he'll do some jobs. Chris Keith and Brian Olszewski's on the CD, and also Chip Willis, who will be appearing with us at the London Jazz Rib Festival. Chip is a fine tenor player, a student of Rusty Bryant, and a fine vocalist. So, you know, so anyway, there's those musicians. I had a couple brass players on there, Bob Masters on trumpet, Dale Naraki on trumpet, who has a big band, Swings the Thing, and then Jim Masters, who's on faculty at Ohio State University and plays with the Jazz Arts Group and, you know, just all kinds of things. I don't know what all Jim's doing, but you know, a large, diverse group of people, depending on the tunes.
Well, Linda, it's been great talking to you. We have a few more minutes left, but are there anything that, like gigs or anything, other projects or anything you'd like to talk about? Sometimes I forget to ask the guests that.
Okay, well, as far as the jazz organ band, well, what's coming up, we're playing August the 8th at the London Jazz Rib Festival from 1:30 to 3:30, okay, and then we're going down to the Dayton Museum of Art on August 14th to play on their concert series down there. It'll be Don Hales, Carrie, and I going to Dayton And Ron Jones, alto saxophonist from Louisville, Kentucky, is coming up to guest with us. We're doing a joint concert together with that. And then I have a job at Dick's Den in September with the organ group. A couple of those coming up. E-Skip is active in the studio. We play out occasionally. It's a gear nightmare. I mean, we only play out, it's crazy. I've got like 6 keyboards. It's like, well, that's just, I need them. If I don't have this one, it doesn't work. And then I play regularly as a drummer with Uncle Fester. And we've got some things coming up. That's a hard rock cover band. And do a lot of AC/DC and Mountain and, you know, that kind of 70s classic rock. And so that's pretty much what I'm doing. You know, the organ group, you know, that's more jazz-oriented. The organ group where I back up Chip, you know, which is a little bit more jazz, blues, and R&B, old-school kind of stuff. The Skip group, which is more art rock. And then Uncle Fester, you know, which is a very enjoyable band for me also.
Well, I definitely want to come hear all of them, and I just think it's great. And I want to thank you, Linda, for being on. It just it's been really great talking to you. I think we can do you have so many things and so many stories. We could probably do another show or more, but I really appreciate it. Is there anything you'd like to say to the audience or the fans out there before we close?
Well, I just thank you for your support all these years, and if you know my music's new to you, I look forward to maybe having your support there, and support your local artists, because we all need it.
Well, thank you so much, Linda, and have a great evening. And thanks, everyone, for listening to John Talk Radio tonight. And everybody, have a great day, and we'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
Thank you.